Roses. I smell roses. He glanced behind us at Nathaniel and Caleb. Nathaniel I'd invited. Caleb had nearly cried when I didn't want to bring him. Whatever Merle had said to him had well and truly scared him. I could taste the sweet cloying perfume on the back of my tongue, and no one could smell it but me. Shit. Belmort's voice whispered through my head.
Did you truly believe you could escape me?
I did escape you. What? Jason asked. I shook my head, concentrating on the voice in my head and the thickening scent of roses.
You did not escape. You fed me, and you will feed me again and again until I am sated.
Jean-Claude says you're never sated. She laughed in my head, and it was like having the inside of my skull rubbed with fur, as if she could touch things with her voice that no one should have touched with her hands. That purring contralto laugh rolled through my body, raising goosebumps along my skin. I had an image, a memory in my head. There was a huge bed and a mass of bodies on it. It was a jumble of arms, legs, chests, groins, all male. Then one man raised up, only his upper body, and I glimpsed Belle underneath him. He lowered his body and she vanished from view. It was like watching a nest of snakes. So much movement. Disconnected in the candlelit dark, as if each limb were something separate and alive without the body. Belle's arm rose above the mass of bodies, and then she swam her way to the top, peeled the men from her naked body until she stood in the midst of them, their hands reaching up to her, pleading with her. She had released the ardor upon them and fed and fed and fed, until she rose from the mass of flesh, glowing with power, her eyes so bright with dark flames that they cast shadows, as she half-stepped, half-floated from the bed. One man's body had fallen to the floor, forgotten. He lay very still as she stalked nude and ripe with curves, glowing with power. She walked over the body of the man who had given everything to satisfy her needs, while the other men reached for her, begged for her not to stop. The men began to rise to their knees, or fall off the bed in an effort to follow. At least two other bodies lay on the bed forever still, forever gone. Three of them dead, loved to death, and still the others begged for more. Still they tried to stand and follow her. I knew it was Jean-Claude that she had tied to a chair and made watch. I knew it was him, and not me, that watched her with fearful, hungry eyes. But when she walked past him, without so much as a caress, I choked on his despair. Part of his punishment for daring to leave her. Anita! Anita! The voice seemed distant. Someone touched my shoulder. I gasped and was brought back, blinking. Breath harsh in my throat. I was still seat-belted into the jeep. We were still on 270, about to turn on 44. I wasn't tied to a chair. I wasn't in Belmort's lair. I was safe. But the sweet scent of roses clung to me like some kind of evil perfume. Jason had been calling my name, but it was Nathaniel's hand on my shoulder. "Are you all right?" Jason asked. I nodded, then shook my head. "Belle's messing with me." Nathaniel squeezed my shoulder. I had opened my mouth to say, "Maybe you shouldn't be touching me right now," when the ardor roared through me. The heat rushed over my skin in beads of sweat, brought my pulse pounding, rising like some ripe fruit to fill my throat, stop my breath. So for a moment I was drowning in the beat and pulse of my own body. I could hear my blood like a roaring flood. I could feel every pulse, every drop to the tingling tips of my fingers and toes. I had never been so aware of how very much blood was coursing through my veins as in that one heart-stopping moment. I put my hand over Nathaniel's, where it still gripped my shoulder. His skin was so warm, almost hot. I turned towards him. I looked into those lavender eyes, and just the intensity of my gaze drew him closer. Close enough to rest his cheek against my seat. I had enough left of me inside my head to think, dimly. He must have undone his seatbelt, but there wasn't enough left of me to care for his safety. All I could think was, it brought him closer to me, and I wanted him closer. Anita! Jason's voice. Anita, what the hell is happening? My skin is crawling with whatever it is. It feels like the ardor, but it's not! I never took my gaze from Nathaniel's face. Jason's voice was like a buzzing insect. Noise, something I heard but didn't really listen to. I lifted Nathaniel's hand from my shoulder and pulled it gently against my lips. His hand cut the lower part of my face. My breath was warm against him, and the heat of it brought the scent of him to me. His hand smelled not only of warmth and blood, but of everything he touched that day. Faint traces that soap could not erase completely. His hand smelled of life, and I wanted it. "Anita, talk to me," Jason said. "What's happening?" Caleb asked. "Why is it so hard to breathe in the car?" "Power," Jason said. "I don't know what kind yet." I pulled Nathaniel's hand past my face until my lips glided over his wrist, and there, just under the skin was a new warmth. I flicked my tongue across the skin of his wrist, and he shuddered. "Anita," Jason said. I could hear him, but it was utterly unimportant. The only thing that was important was the warmth of skin and that faint pulse just below. I opened my mouth wide, lips pulled back to taste that pulse. The Jeep swerved violently, throwing Nathaniel backwards into one side, tearing his hand from me. He landed in Caleb's lap. I looked at Jason then, really looked at him. In the back of my mind, I knew it was Jason, but in the front of my mind, all I could really see was the pulse in the side of his neck. It beat against his skin like a trapped thing. I knew I could free it, make it rush red and hot into my mouth. I unbuckled my seatbelt. That froze me for a second, because I was fanatic about seatbelt safety. My mother would be alive today if she'd used hers. I never rode in a moving car without one. Never. So deep-rooted was that fear, it pushed Belle back, pushed back the bloodlust she'd raised in me. I found my voice, hoarse and strange, but mine. "I thought it was the ardor she raised, but it's not." "Bloodlust," Jason said. I nodded, my hand still frozen on the unbuckled seatbelt. "Bloodlust feels like the ardor, but not. Sometimes you don't know which lust it is until you find out if he's going for your neck or your groin." I blinked at Jason. "What did you just say?" I never heard the answer. If there was one, Belle roared back through me, and I was suddenly more concerned with the beating of his pulse in his neck than the fact that his mouth was moving. I heard no sound except that overwhelming thunder of my own blood, my own heart, my own throbbing, pulsing body. I was sliding over the front seat towards him, and hadn't remembered moving or wanting to. He hit the wheel again, sending me back across the car, against the far door. The moment my back hit the door, I could hear the angry honking of horns as the Jeep slid through traffic sideways. Then it evened out, going straight again. Jason was giving me wide eyes. "I can't drive with you feeding on me." My voice was thick. "I don't think I care." I sat up, my hands on the seat to keep him from throwing me against the door again. "Nathaniel! Caleb, keep her away from me until I can find a safe place to pull over." I was awkwardly straddling the gear shift when Nathaniel put his arm in front of my face. He didn't try and touch me, but he held his wrist close enough for me to smell the warmth of his skin. Then he slowly drew his arm back into the back seat, and I followed, sliding between the seats, following the pull of his flesh, like there was a line tied from him to me. I spilled into the back seat. Nathaniel was sitting on his side of the seat now. I knelt over his body, straddling him. I could feel him stretch tight inside his shorts, even through my jeans, but today that wasn't nearly as important as the smooth line of his throat. He'd braided his hair before we left, so that neck was bare. The Jeep swerved again, and I fell onto the floorboard at Caleb's feet. We'd been lucky so far to avoid an accident or the concrete median on the road. Our luck would run out, and I wasn't sure I cared. "If you can't take sex from Nathaniel yet, I don't think you should take blood. He's still weak." I heard Jason's voice, as though it were coming from far away. I stared up at what sat above me, his jean-clad legs brushing my body. For sex, Caleb wasn't desirable, but for blood. I came to my knees between his legs and began to pull myself up Caleb's body, fingers digging into the jeans, feeling the flesh underneath. My hand slid under his untucked button-up shirt with its loud comic book pictures. His skin was so warm. My fingers slid upward, touching the ring in his belly button. I hesitated there, tracing the edge of the metal ring, pulling on it gently, feeling the skin stretch until he made a small sound of protest. I stared up into his face, and whatever he saw there widened his eyes, made his lips part in a small ooh of surprise. I traced my fingers up his stomach, his chest, my arms lost under the oversized shirt, until when my hand slid over his shoulders, the shirt began to raise, exposing his stomach. The sight of that bare skin began to raise other hungers, for flesh instead of merely blood. But Belle roared down that metaphysical leash she'd attached to me, and the beast receded before it had truly risen. She wanted me to want what she wanted, and in that moment I knew that though she had animals to call, she did not share their beast, their craving of flesh. The thought was too rational, and the leash loosened, and I could think for myself. "Why do you care if I take blood or flesh? You can feed off both energies." "You've been feeding on Richard all day," I asked.
"Perhaps I am tired of flesh."
I had a flash, as if I read her thought. You couldn't make Richard feed. He fought you all day, let you suck him dry, but you couldn't make him attack anyone else. Her anger was like hot metal shoved against my skin. It bowed my back, brought a gasp from my throat. Caleb grabbed my arms, or I would have collapsed. Belle's voice purred through my head.
"Zalu was surprisingly strong, but he is not my animal to call, nor is he attracted to the dead. But you are, ma petite. Oh, yes, you are."
Her power poured over me, but it wasn't the heat of bloodlust. It was cold, the coldness of the grave. The moment the energy touched me, my own power flared to life. That part of me that raised the dead. It flared inside me as if Belle's cold energy was some sort of fuel for my own cool fire.
"You are mine, ma petite. Mine in ways that Alou cannot imagine. His connection to the dead is accidental. Yours was fated from the moment you were born."
Her power was the power of the grave, of death itself. But so was mine. She meant to make a point, but she'd weaken my necromancy, and she was just another kind of dead. I knew how to handle the dead. I drew a breath, drawing in my own magic, getting ready to cast her out. I'd done it before, but her chill changed to heat before I could finish that breath. The bloodlust washed my magic away, drowned it in a flood of need. Her voice dripped across my skin like warm honey, as if the dark power of her eyes had melted across my skin.
"The power of the grave is yours to control, but not the power of desire. Desire in all its forms is mine to control."
If I had had air to breathe, I would have screamed, but there was no air, and no sight for a swimming, dizzying moment. But I was drowning in sounds, blood rushing through my body, my heart wet and thudding, my pulse like a second heartbeat in 1,000 places under my skin. I could hear, and I could feel. I could feel Caleb's chest under my hands, feel the roughness of the hair that traced the edge of his nipples, and finally the nipple themselves, growing hard and firm under my fingers. The tiny metal barbells that had pierced them were a distraction. I wanted to roll his nipples between my fingertips, and the metal interfered. Like a toothpick in your sandwich, they got in the way. I had a moment where Belle thought about ripping them out, and that was so not my thought that it helped me crawl back into my own head, at least a little. When my vision cleared, Caleb's eyes were unfocused, his lips half-parted. Through me, it was almost as if Belle herself touched him, and her touch spread lust, lust of every kind. I was in my own head, my own skin, but Belle's hunger was inside me too, and I couldn't push it out. She was right. The blood hunger was not death. I tore my arms through Caleb's shirt, popping the buttons loose, baring his upper body. When I channeled Jean-Claude's bloodlust, I was always attracted to neck, wrist, bend of the arm, sometimes the inside of the groin, all nice major arteries or veins, but Belle didn't look high or low. She gazed at Caleb's chest like it was a prime piece of steak, cooked just right. My own logic tried to argue. There were other places where there was more blood, much closer to the surface. The sheer surprise of not going for someplace more usual helped push her back. Caleb's voice came heavy.
"Why did you stop?"
"I don't think it's sex she's wanting," Nathaniel said, voice quiet. His voice turned my gaze to him. If what was driving me had been the ardor, it might have been enough to have me crawl to him. But Nathaniel was right. This wasn't about sex. This was about food, and Nathaniel wasn't food. Did that mean that Caleb was food? Not a pretty thought.
What do you mean?
Caleb asked. I gazed up at Caleb's bare chest, that young, half-finished face. He looked so puzzled. I said it out loud, though I wasn't talking to anyone in the car. He doesn't understand. Bell's whisper.
He will soon enough.
Looks like it's your turn to take one for the team, Jason's voice from the front.
What?
You're going to get munched on, Jason said. The combination of my own moral dilemma with the fact that Bell had picked an odd spot for taking blood, one that just didn't make sense to me, was helping me swim to the surface. I knelt back on the floorboard, pulling a little free of Caleb's body. No, I said it out loud, and none of the men answered me, as if they'd all caught up to the fact that I wasn't really talking to any of them. Bell's voice in my head.
I have been gentle until now, ma petite.
I am not your ma petite, so stop fucking calling me that.
If you will not take kindness from me,
then I will cease to offer it.
If this is your idea of kindness, then I'd hate to see... I never finished the thought, because Belle showed me that indeed she had been kind. She didn't roll over me. She crashed into me in a mind-numbing, breast-stealing, heart-stopping swat of power. For an instant, or for an eternity, I hung suspended. The Jeep was gone. Caleb was gone. I couldn't see, or feel, or be. It was neither light, nor dark, nor up, nor down. I'd had near-death experiences. I'd fainted before, passed out. But that moment when Bell's power fell through me, that was the closest to true nothingness that I'd ever experienced. Into that nothingness, that void, Bell's voice fell.
Jean-Claude has begun the dance, but he has left it unfinished between you, the wolf, and himself. He has allowed sentiment to cloud his judgment. It makes me question how well I taught him.
I tried to speak, but couldn't remember where my mouth was, or how to draw a breath. I couldn't remember how to answer her.
I discovered this with the wolf, but could not mend it, for he is not my animal to call. I do not understand dogs, and a wolf is very much a dog.
Her voice whispered through me, lower and lower, trembling through my body. But for her voice to dance through my body, I had to have a body for her to use. I fell back into my body as if falling from a great height. I was left gasping on the floorboards, eyes staring up at Caleb's startled face and Nathaniel's worried one. Belle's voice glided through my body like a knowledgeable hand. I suddenly knew who had trained Jean-Claude to use his voice as a tool of seduction.
But you, ma petite, I understand you.
I drew a deep, quaking breath, and it hurt all the way to my chest, as if I'd gone a long time without breathing. My voice came hoarse. What are you talking about?
The fourth mark, ma petite. Without the fourth mark, you are not truly Jean-Claude's. It is like the difference between engagement and marriage. One is permanent, the other not necessarily so.
I understood what she meant a second before I saw two dancing, honey-colored flames appear in the air over me. I knew it was the second mark, because I'd had the second mark 3 times before, twice from Jean-Claude and once from a vampire I'd killed. I'd never been able to protect myself from it before. I knew from experience that nothing physical would save me. It wasn't something you could hit or shoot. I hated things you couldn't hit or shoot. But I had other skills now that weren't exactly physical. I reached down that long metaphysical cord to Jean-Claude. Belle's voice floated over me. She was delaying her moment, drawing out her pleasure and my fear.
Jean-Claude is ours dead. He cannot help you.
The dark flames of her eyes began to descend like some evil angel coming to eat my soul. I did the only thing I could think to do. I reached down the other half of our metaphysical cord. I reached out to a place that hadn't helped me for months. I reached out to Richard. I had an image of Richard in the hot bath water, cradled in Jamil's arms. Richard looked up as if he could see me. He whispered my name, but either he was too weak to push me away, or he didn't try. For a moment, it was as if it was meant to be. Then I was yanked back, shoved into my own head, my own body again. Richard hadn't cast me out this time. Dark honey flames hovered over my face, and there was a vague outline, a ghost of long dark hair, the mist of a face. Caleb was yelling, "What's in the car with us? I can't see anything, but I can feel it. What the fuck is it?" Nathaniel's voice came hushed and strangely loud. "Belmont!" I had no time to look up to see the others because the phantom lips were speaking.
"I will not allow you to gain strength from your wolf. I have given you the first marks, and you did not even know it. I will give you the second mark, here and now. And tonight, with Musette as my proxy, I will give you the third. When Jean-Claude and I are equal within you, three for three, then you will come to me, ma petite. You will travel the world if I ask it. Do anything, simply to taste my sweet blood."
That phantom mouth lowered towards mine. I knew somehow that if she laid a ghostly kiss on me, that I would be hers. I did what I always did. I tried to hit at that face, and there was nothing to touch. I screamed wordlessly and sent out a metaphysical cry, "Help me!" Suddenly, I could smell forest, trees, fresh-turned earth, wet leaves underfoot, and the sweet musk of wolf. Belle could stop me from reaching out to Richard, but she couldn't keep him from reaching out to me. Richard's power rose like a sweet-scented cloud above me, pushing back those glowing eyes, that phantom mouth. She laughed, and it slid over my body, made me shudder, and my breath catch in my throat. It felt so good, even while my head screamed that it was bad.
"Did you hear someone laugh?"
Caleb asked it. Jason said no. Nathaniel said yes. Belle whispered along my skin, and even Richard's power breathing against my body couldn't keep her voice out.
"With the touch of your wolf's flesh, you might be able to keep me at bay, but not from a distance. The closer the flesh, the closer the ties, and the more powerful. You are already mine, ma petite. You cannot win free of me."
Those eyes began to float lower again. Richard's power rose above me like a soft shield. Belle's power floated on the surface of the energy like a leaf on a pond. Then she began to push into it. Through it.
"Help me!"
I screamed it out loud to everyone, anyone, and no one. I felt Nathaniel's hand on mine, and that phantom kiss did hesitate, did turn and look at Nathaniel. I felt her call him, like a deep thrumming down my bones. Leopard had been her first animal to call. If she owned me, she owned my pard. Nathaniel reached out his free hand as if he could see her.
"No!"
I jerked free of him, and the moment I broke physical contact, it was as if Nathaniel was less real to her. She turned those dark honey eyes back to me.
"I will have them all, ma petite, eventually."
"No," I said it, but my voice was soft, because I believed she was right.
"You will give them to me, all of them."
Fear poured through me, as if I'd been plunged into ice water. The thought of what Belle would do to my pard, my friends. No, I could not let this happen. "Fuck you! Fuck you, Belle, and the horse you rode in on!" My anger, my fear, seemed to feed Richard's power. The sweet, nose-wrinkling musk of wolf was so thick it was like being wrapped in invisible fur. The jeep slewed to one side. The angry honking of horns and squealing brakes followed it. Jason had given up on finding a safe place and just stopped against the concrete median. Nathaniel and Caleb were thrown across the seat and into the passenger side doors. I didn't have time to worry about the fact that no one seemed to be wearing their damn seatbelts. Belle's eyes pushed through Richard's power. It wasn't effortless. He made her work for every inch. But those burning eyes, that ghostly outline, got closer, closer, until I held my breath, as if afraid that if I breathed in too hard it would bring her against my mouth. I caught movement from the corner of my eye. Jason was between the seats. He'd stopped the jeep, thrown off his seatbelt. He shoved his hand through the ghost thing above me as if he could see it. He grabbed my shoulder, and the moment he touched me, Richard's beast welled up inside me. I'd always thought it was my beast that moved through me, but this, whatever this was Richard, not me. His wolf poured into me like scalding water rushing into a cup, filling me to the brim, emptying my skin of leopard or death, until my spine bowed, my hands failed, my mouth opened in a soundless scream. I could feel fur rubbing inside my body, strong nails digging. The wolf was struggling to find some way out of my body. Belle hissed at me like some great ghostly cat. The eyes retreated, hovering in the air near the jeep roof, as Jason pulled me into the front seat and cradled me against his body. His closeness seemed to quiet the wolf, so that I felt it sit, panting, eager-eyed, staring up at the shape by the ceiling with hungry, arrogant eyes. Jason's eyes were his wolf's eyes, and today they seemed perfect for his face. But it was Richard's power, the power of the Thronus Roke clan, that wrapped around both of us. I had never felt Richard's beast so thick inside me. It was as if I was a purse, a bag, holding his beast, feeling it pace inside me as if my flesh were a cage it could not escape from. Belle's voice floated down upon us, and this time it stung, hot with her anger.
You can ride all day in the arms of your wolf, but there is still the banquet tonight. Musette will be there, and through her, ma petite, I will be there.
My voice came out, with a low edge of growl.
I am not your ma petite. You will be,
she said, and the eyes slowly faded, until only the lingering scent of roses remained to remind me that we'd won this round, but there would be others. Jean-Claude's memories knew Belle too well to think otherwise. She would never give up. Not once she decided to own something, or someone. Belle Morte had decided that I would be hers. Jean-Claude had never known her to change her mind about something like that. That was so unfair. Wasn't it a lady's prerogative to change her mind? Of course, Belle wasn't exactly a lady. She was a 2,000-year-old vampire, and they weren't known for changing their minds, their habits, or their goals. The last time a master vamp had come to town and tried to steal me from Jean-Claude, I'd ended up in a coma for a week. Richard had gotten his throat torn out, and Jean-Claude had nearly died for real. Vampires were always either trying to kill me or own me. God, I hated being popular. Chapter 29. Nathaniel had gotten one of the extra crosses out of the glove compartment. I always carried spare crosses, just like spare ammo. When you hunt vampires, running out of either one is really bad. It was sheer stupidity on my part to have put crosses around the Circus of the Damned, but not on me. Some days I'm just slow. I was back in the front seat, but I was shaking. No, that didn't quite cover it. There was a fine tremble in my hands. Small muscles in my body kept twitching at odd moments. I was cold, and it was one of those glorious end-of-summer days, sun-warmed, sparkling bright and soft at the same time. We drove through a wash of blue sky and sunshine, and I was cold, a cold that no amount of blankets was really going to help. Nathaniel was curled over my lower body like a living blanket, wedged between my legs and the floorboard. I'd bitched about how dangerous it was, but I hadn't complained too much. I didn't have any real blankets in the car. I was spending so much time in shock lately, I'd have to remedy that. The trees along the 44 had given way to houses, and an occasional old school being rehabbed into apartments, churches, buildings of no discernible use, but old, tired. Okay, maybe that last was just me. I stroked my hand over Nathaniel's head, over and over, on the warm silk of his hair. His head in my lap, his arms wrapped around my waist, his body wedged between my legs. Sometimes Nathaniel made me think about sex. But sometimes, like now, it was just comfort, just closeness. You can't have that with most people, because they're busy thinking about sex. I think that's why dogs are so damn popular. You can cuddle a dog as much as you like, and the dog never thinks about sex, or pushing your social boundaries in any way. Unless you happen to be eating. Dogs will invade your social boundaries for table scraps, unless trained to do otherwise. But hey, it's a dog, not a person in a fur suit. Right now, what I needed was a pet, not a person. Nathaniel could be both, an uncomfortable but truthful fact. Jason drove. Caleb had the back seat to himself. No one spoke. I don't think anyone knew what to say. I wanted Jean-Claude awake. I wanted to tell him what Belle had done. I wanted him to tell me that there was a way to keep her from doing anything else, short of giving me the fourth mark. The fourth mark would make me ageless and immortal as long as Jean-Claude didn't die. Theoretically, he could live forever, and with the fourth mark, so could I. So why had I refused it so far? One, it scared me. I wasn't sure as a Christian how I felt about living forever. I mean, what happened to heaven, and God, and the judgment thing? Theologically, what would it mean? On a more mundane level, how much closer would it bind me to Jean-Claude? He could already invade my dreams. What would it mean if I took that one last step? Or was refusing the fourth mark just another way not to give myself completely to anyone? Maybe. But if the only way to keep Belle from taking me was to let Jean-Claude have me, I knew which choice I was making. I wondered if I called my priest now, could he get back to me on the theological implications of the fourth mark before full dark tonight? Father Mike had answered questions equally as weird for me over the years. Anita, Jason said, and his voice held a note of anxiety. I glanced at him and realized he'd probably been trying to get my attention for a while. Sorry, thinking too hard. I think we're being followed. That raised my eyebrows. What do you mean? When I nearly caused a four-car pileup so I could touch you, I caught a glimpse of a car in the rear view. It was close, like tailgating close. It was one of those cars that nearly hit us when I slammed on the brakes. So, we're in heavy traffic. A lot of people tailgate. Yeah, but everyone else that was close to us when I stopped got away from us as fast as they could. This car is still behind us. I glanced in the side mirror and saw a dark blue Jeep. Are you sure it's the same car? I didn't get a number, but it's the same make, same color, and there are two men in it, one dark-haired, one blonde with glasses. I studied the Jeep that seemed to be following our Jeep. Two men, one dark, one light. It could have been a coincidence. Of course, maybe it wasn't. Let's just go on the theory that it's following us, I said. What? Jason said. I lose them? No, I said. Cut across traffic and take the first exit, as long as it doesn't take us to the circus. I don't want to lead them to Jean-Claude. Almost every monster in St. Louis knows that the Master of City's lair is under the Circus of the Damned, Jason said. But he changed lanes, moving us a little closer to the exit row. But the guys behind us don't know that's where we're headed. He shrugged and moved over two more lanes, setting up for the exit. The blue Jeep waited until we were actually exiting with two cars between us before it crossed over. If we hadn't been watching for it, or there had been a taller car between our Jeep and theirs, I wouldn't have seen them exit. But I was, and there wasn't, and I did. Shit, I said, but I was feeling warmer. Nothing like action to ground and center a person. Who are these guys? Jason asked out loud what I was wondering. Caleb glanced behind. Why would someone be following us? Reporters? Jason made the word a question. I don't think so, I said. I'd lost sight of everything but the top of the Jeep floating above the car roofs behind us. Which way do I turn? He'd come to the bottom of the exit ramp. I shook my head. I don't know. Dealer's choice. Who were they? Why were they following us? Usually when people start following me, I know I'm into something. Today, I had no clue. Neither of the current cases that I was helping RPIT with should have had people following me. I wish they were reporters, but the situation didn't have that feel to it. Jason turned right. One car turned left. One turned right, and the Jeep pulled in behind it. There were little flags on the street signs, Italian flags with the words, The Hill, on them. People on the hill always let you know that you were there, and that they loved their Italian heritage. Even the fire hydrants were painted green, red, and white like flags. Nathaniel raised his head off my thigh enough to say, Is it Belle? What? I asked, vision still glued to the side mirror. Are they daytime help for Belle? He asked in his quiet voice. I thought about that. I've never run into a vamp that had more than one human servant, but I'd run into several that had more than one Renfield. Renfield is what most American vamps called humans that served them not through mystical connections, but because they acted as blood donors and wanted to be vampires themselves. Back when I hunted vampires and didn't sleep with them, I called all humans associated with vamps human servants. Now I know better. Could be Renfields, I guess. What's a Renfield? Caleb asked. He was turned in the seat, looking directly back at the car between us and the blue Jeep. Turn around, Caleb. When that car turns off, I don't want the Jeep to know that we've noticed them. He turned around immediately without arguing, which was unusual for Caleb. I didn't approve of threatening people to gain their obedience, but there were some that nothing else seemed to work with. Maybe he was one of them. I explained where the Renfield was. Like the guy in Dracula who ate insects, Caleb said. Exactly, I said. Cool, he said, and seemed to mean it. I'd once asked Jean-Claude what they called Renfields before the release of the book Dracula in 1897. Jean-Claude had said, slaves. He'd probably been kidding, but I'd never had the heart to ask again. The car behind us pulled into one of the narrow driveways. The blue Jeep was suddenly revealed. I forced myself to not look directly at it and only use a side mirror, but it was hard. I wanted to turn around and stare. Knowing that I shouldn't made it all the more tempting. There was nothing ominous about the Jeep, or even the two men visible in it. They both had short hair, clean, well-groomed. The Jeep was even shiny and clean. The only thing ominous was the fact that they were still behind us. Then, it turned into a narrow driveway. Just like that. Not a threat. Shit, I said. Ditto, Jason said. But I saw his shoulder sag, as if tension drained away with that one word. Are we becoming too paranoid? I asked. Maybe, Jason said, but he was still spending almost as much time staring back in the rearview mirror as straight ahead, as if he couldn't quite believe it. Neither could I, so I didn't tell him to watch the road. He was watching forward okay, and I, too, was expecting the blue Jeep to pull out and start after us again. Just a ruse, guys, not really harmless after all. But it didn't happen. We drove down the long, car-crowded street, until the Jeep's driveway was hidden by trees and parked cars. "Looks like it was just driving our way," Jason said. "Looks like," I said. Nathaniel rubbed his face against my leg. "You still smell scared, like you don't believe it." "I don't believe it," I said. "Why not?" Caleb asked, leaning in between the seats from the back seat. I finally turned around in the seat, but I wasn't looking at Caleb. I was staring past him at the empty street. "Experience," I said. I smelled roses, and a second later the cross around my neck began to glow, softly. "Jesus," Jason whispered. My heart was thumping painfully in my chest, but my voice came solid. "She can't roll me while I'm wearing a cross." "You sure of that?" Caleb asked, as he moved back away from me into the far reaches of the seat. "Yeah," I said, "I'm sure of that." "Why?" he asked, eyes wide. I blinked at him as the soft white luminosity grew brighter in the tree shadows, almost invisible in full sunlight, over and over again. "Because I believe," I said, voice soft as the glow around my neck, and as sure. I'd seen crosses burst into a white-hot light, so bright it was blinding, but that was when I'd been face-to-face with a vamp that had meant me harm. Belle was far away, and the glow showed that. I kept waiting for the scent of roses to grow stronger again, but it never did. It stayed faint, definitely there, but it didn't grow on the air. I waited for Belle's voice in my head, but it didn't come. Every time she had spoken directly in my mind, the smell of roses had been thick. The sweet perfume stayed faint, and Belle's voice was gone from me. I squeezed the cross with my hand, feeling the heat, the power of it, skin prickling up my arm. Thrumming like a continuous heartbeat against my hand, Caleb asked how could I believe. What I always wanted to ask is, how can you not believe? I felt Belle's anger like warmth on the air. Power filled the Jeep in a neck-ruffling, breath-stealing tide. So much effort, and all she could send was an image of herself sitting in front of her dressing table. Her long black hair was unbound like a cloak around a dressing gown of gold and black. She watched herself in the mirror with eyes full of honey fire, like the eyes of the blind. Empty, except for the color of her power. I whispered out loud, "You cannot touch me. Not now." She looked into the mirror as if I were standing behind her, and she could see me. Rage changed her beauty into something frightening, a mere mask of pale beauty that looked as false as any Halloween mask. Then she turned and looked past me, beyond me, and the look of fear on her face was so real, so unexpected that I turned too, and I saw something. Darkness. Darkness like a wave, rising up, up over me, over us, like a liquid mountain towering to the impossibly tall sky. The room that Belle had constructed of dreams and power collapsed, shredded like the dream it was, and what ate at the corners of that bright candlelit room was darkness. darkness, absolute darkness, so black that it held shines of other colors like an oil slick, or a trick of the eye. As if this blackness was a darkness made up of every color that had ever existed, every sight that had ever been seen, every sigh, every scream since time began. I had heard the term primordial darkness, but until this moment, I had never understood what it meant. Now I understood. I truly understood. And I despaired. I stared up, up at an ocean of darkness that rose above me as if the earth and sky had never existed. This was darkness before the light, before the word of God. It was like a breath of an older creation. But if this was creation, it was nothing I could understand, nothing I wanted to understand. Bell screamed first. I think I was too awestruck to scream, or even to be afraid. I looked into the primordial abyss, the first darkness, and knew despair, but not fear. My mind kept trying to find words to describe what it was. It did loom over me like a mountain, because it had weight and that claustrophobic feel of a mountain poised to it came crashing down. But it was not a mountain. It was more like an ocean. If an ocean could have risen up taller than the tallest mountain and stood before you, waiting, defying gravity and every other known law of physics. Like with an ocean, I knew, could sense, that I only saw that wide glimpse from shore, that I could only begin to guess at the depth and width, the unthinkable fathoms of darkness that lay before me. Did strange creatures swim inside it? Were there things within the dark that only nightmares or dreams could reveal? I watched the flickering liquid dark, and felt the numbness of despair begin to wear away. It was as if the despair had been a shield to protect me, to numb me, so that my mind wouldn't break. For a few minutes I had been intellect, thinking, what is it? How can I make sense of it? The numbness began to recede as if that huge blackness sucked it away, fed on it. I was left standing before her, trembling, shaking, my skin running cold, and I felt that darkness sucking at me, feeding off my warmth. In that moment, I knew what I faced. It was a vampire, maybe the very first vampire. Something so ancient that to think of human bodies or flesh to contain this darkness was laughable. She was the primordial dark made real. She was why humans feared the dark, just the darkness. Not what lies in the dark, not what hides there, but why we fear the darkness itself. There was a time when she walked among us, fed on us, and when darkness falls somewhere in the back of our skulls, we remember the hungry dark. That shining ocean of blackness reached out towards me, and I knew that if it touched me, I would die. I couldn't turn away, couldn't run, because you can't run from the dark, not really. The light does not last. That last thought was mine, wasn't Bell's. I stared up at the darkness as it began to bend over me, and knew it lied. It's the dark that doesn't last. Dawn comes and slays the darkness, not the other way around. If I could have found enough air, I would have screamed, but I was left with only a whisper. The darkness bent towards me, and I couldn't shoot it or hit it, and I didn't have enough personal psychic power to keep her at bay. I did the only thing I could think of. I prayed. I whispered, "Hail Mary. Full of grace, the Lord is with thee." The darkness hesitated. "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb." The faintest of shivers ran through the liquid dark. "Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us." There was suddenly light in the darkness. My cross was around my neck in the dreamscape. The metal shone like a captive star, shining in white, and unlike in real life, I could see beyond the brilliance of it. I watched that pure white light chase back the dark. I was suddenly aware of the car seat, the seat belt across my chest, Nathaniel's body wrapped around my legs. The cross around my neck was glowing hot white, even in sunlight, so that I had to look away from it. And still the white, white light blurred my vision. The cross wouldn't have still been burning if the danger had passed. I waited for the mother of all darkness to make her next move. The air in the Jeep was suddenly soft, sweet, like the perfect summer night when you can smell every blade of grass, every leaf, every flower, like a scented blanket that wraps you in air softer than cashmere, lighter than silk, a sweet blanket of air. My throat suddenly felt cooler, as if I'd taken a sip of cold water. I could feel it coating my throat, and there was a faint undertaste like jasmine. Nathaniel buried his face in my lap to protect his eyes from the light. It was like wearing a white sun around my neck.
Shit, Jason said. I'm having trouble seeing the road. Can you tone that down?
The world was full of white halos, and I didn't dare turn my head to look at him. The scent of night was all I could smell, as if everything else had vanished. I could almost re-drink the cool, perfumed water that coated my throat. So real. So overwhelmingly real. I managed to whisper, "No." I kept waiting for words in my head, but there was nothing else but silence, and the smell of a summer night, the taste of cool water, and the growing sense that something large was drawing nearer. It was like standing on the train tracks when you feel the first vibration down the metal lines, and you know you should get off, but you can't see anything. As far as you can look, the tracks are clear. There is only that metallic vibration, like a pulse beat against your feet, to let you know that several tons of steel are hurtling towards you. People die every year on train tracks, and often their dying words are, "I didn't see the train." I've always thought that trains must be magical that way, or otherwise people would see them and get the fuck off the tracks. I could feel the vibration of her rushing towards me, and I would gladly have gotten off the tracks, but the tracks were inside my head, nailed across my body, and I couldn't figure out how to run from that. Something rubbed against my skin like some large animal pressing its body along the length of mine. I felt Nathaniel draw back, but I couldn't see him through the white light. His voice came, breathless, frightened. "What was that?" I opened my mouth, not even sure what to say, when that roll of invisible animal hit my chest and the cross. The cross flared so bright that most of us screamed, cried out. Jason had to hit the brakes and stop the Jeep in the middle of the street, blinded by the light, unable to see to drive, I think. The light began to dim. For a second I wondered if the brilliance had fried my retinas. Then my vision began to clear through a veil of spots. I could still feel it. Her, pressing against me, pinning me to the seat, pressing over the cross, as if she were eating the light. Nathaniel stared up at me, his lavender eyes gone leopard, a deep, deep gray that held a hint of blue in the sunlight. "She's a shifter," he whispered, and I knew why. Shapeshifters could not be vampires or vice versa. The lycanthropy virus seemed to be proof against whatever made you a vampire. You could not be both, it was a rule. But whatever pressed against me now was animal, not human. I couldn't get a sense of what kind of animal, but an animal it was. How the mother of all darkness happened to be both a vampire and a shapeshifter at the same time was a problem for another day. Right then, I didn't care what she was. I just wanted her to leave me the fuck alone. The cross was still glowing, but only the metal itself, as if it were hollow and the candles burned inside it. The light was white and flickering now. I'd never seen a cross look so much like fire before, but it was a cold fire. The shape pushed and rolled like it was trying to climb inside me, but the cross kept glowing, acting as a metaphysical shield to keep her out of me. "What can we do to help?" Jason asked. The Jeep was still stopped in the middle of the street. A car trapped behind us was honking its horn. There were cars parked on both sides of the residential street, leaving the car with no way to get past us. The neighborhood was nothing but small, neat houses, none with driveways. Jason hit the blinkers and the car began to back away, trying to turn around. I was almost afraid to open my links to Richard and Jean-Claude. What if the primordial dark could spill down the ties and take them too? Jean-Claude had no faith to fall back on. Richard did, but whether he was actually wearing a cross or not was debatable. It had been a long time since I'd seen Richard wear a cross. While I was still considering, Jason grabbed my hand. The scent of night didn't fade. It was added to, like a layer of color painted over another. The clean musk of wolves filled the night. The cool water that seemed to have passed down my throat now tasted more like loam and forest than perfume. I had an image in my mind of a huge animal head with long teeth, like the largest fangs I'd ever seen. The fur on the head was gold and tawny and reddish, shaded rather than striped, more like a lion than tiger. Eyes like golden fire stared into mine, and that huge mouth opened wide and screamed its frustration in a sound like a panther scream, but decibels lower. Pioneers were always mistaking panther screams for a woman's cries. No one would have mistaken this for a woman. A man, maybe. A man being tortured and screaming for his soul. I screamed back, as if that head were truly right in front of me and not thousands of miles across the world. My scream was echoed by two others. Nathaniel snarled up at me from the floorboard, his mouth showing teeth that were fast becoming fangs. Caleb had slid in between the seats, and his eyes were yellow cat eyes. He started to rub his cheek against my shoulder, as if he were going to scent mark me, then stopped, snarling as if he'd touched that other phantom cat. Jason didn't scream. He growled, that low, fur standing on end sound that has nothing to do with hunting and everything to do with fighting. Not for food, but for survival. It was a sound for guarding territory, chasing out interlopers, getting rid of troublemakers. The sound that says, get out or die. She screamed back, a sound that should have frozen the blood in my veins and reminded me that my ancestors had huddled around their small fires and watched in terror for the shine of eyes outside that flame. But I wasn't thinking like a person. I wasn't even sure thinking was a word for what was moving through my mind. It was more like I was in the moment, completely, utterly. I could feel the leather seat cupping my body, Nathaniel pressed against my legs, his hands tracing higher, Caleb at my shoulder, his cheek against my face, his jaw straining as he snarled, Jason's hand on my arm like it had taken root, become a part of me. I could smell Caleb's skin, the soap he'd been using that morning, and the fear like something bitter underneath that clean skin. Nathaniel moved up on his knees, higher, so that his face was superimposed behind the saber-tooth's head for a moment. But I could smell the vanilla scent of his hair, and there was nothing from the phantom cat. Jason moved in closer, putting his face close to mine, sniffing the air. I smelled soap, shampoo, and the smell of Jason, a scent that had begun to mean home to me, the way the vanilla scent of Nathaniel's hair or Jean-Claude's expensive cologne. Or once, the warm bend of Richard's neck affected me. I didn't mean in a sexual way, but the way fresh-baked bread or your mother's favorite cookies made you feel safe and smell like home. I turned my head to Caleb so that my nose touched his skin. And under the fear, the soap, the soft skin, he smelled of leopard, faint in his human form, but there, a nose-wrinkling, skin-prickling smell. I turned to the weight, pressing against the still glowing cross. I looked into those yellow eyes, gazed upon those fangs that were like nothing that walked the earth today, and it had no scent. Jason was sniffing the air in front of me. His pale wolf eyes met mine, and I knew that he'd figured it out too. As a vampire, she smelled of cool evenings and sweet water, vaguely like jasmine. As a weir animal, she had no scent, because she wasn't there. It was a sending, a psychic sending. It had power, but it wasn't real, not really real, not physical. No matter how much power you put into it, a psychic sending has limits to what it can do physically. It can frighten you into running into traffic, but it can't push you. It can try to trick you into doing things, but it can't hurt you without a physical agent. When she was a vampire, the cross and my faith kept her at bay. As a weir animal, she wasn't real. Nathaniel had literally crawled up through the image I could still see hovering over my chest. He was the one who said it out loud. It has no scent. It's not real, I said. Caleb's voice came out with an edge of growl so deep that it was almost painful to hear. I feel it. Some great cat. Like Pard, but not. Do you smell anything? Jason asked. Caleb sniffed along my body. Any other time I would have accused him of getting too close to my breasts, but not now. He was as serious as I'd ever seen him, as he sniffed along my chest, pushed his face almost into that evil face. He stopped, staring into those yellow eyes from inches away. He hissed like any startled cat. I can't smell it, but I see it. Seeing isn't always believing, I said. What is it? A psychic projection, ascending. The vampire couldn't get past the cross, so it tried another form, but the kitty cat doesn't travel as well as the... whatever the hell she is. I looked into those yellow eyes and watched that massive mouth roar up at me. You have no scent. You aren't real. Only a bad dream. And dreams have no power unless you give it to them. I give you nothing. Go back to where you came from. Go back to the dark. I had a sudden image of a dark, dark room, not pitch black, but as if the only light were reflected from somewhere else. There was a bed with a black silk cover, and a figure lying under that cover. The room was oddly shaped, not square, not circular, almost hexagonal. There There were windows, but I knew somehow that they didn't look out upon the world. Windows to gaze down upon the darkness that never lifted, never changed. I was drawn towards the bed, drawn the way you're drawn in nightmares. I didn't want to look, but I had to look. Didn't want to see, and had to see. I reached out towards that shining black silk. I could tell it was silk because of the way it reflected the light from down below. Far down below, outside the windows. The light flickered, and I knew it was firelight. Nothing electric had ever touched the darkness of this place. My fingertips brushed the silk, and the body underneath the sheet moved in its sleep. Moved the way someone will move when they dream but are not yet awake. I knew in that instant that I was a dream to her too, and I couldn't truly be standing in her inner sanctum, that no matter how real or exact I was, I could not send myself to her and then pull the sheet away. Dreams could not do that. But I also knew in that same moment that all she had done to me today had been done in a sleep that had lasted long and longer, so long that the others sometimes thought she was dead, hoped she was dead, feared she was dead, prayed she was dead. If they had the courage of prayer left in them, who did the soulless dead pray to? A sigh moved through that close, airless room, and on that first breath of air came a whisper of sound, the first sound that the room had heard in centuries. Me. It took me a moment to realize that it was the answer to my question. Who did the soulless dead pray to? Me, the whisper said. The figure under the sheet shifted in its sleep again. Not awake, not yet, but she was swimming upwards, filling in herself, coming closer to wakefulness. I jerked my head back from the sheet. I stepped back from that bed. I did not want to touch her. More than anything else, I did not want to wake her. But since I didn't know how I'd gotten into her room, I couldn't figure out how to get out of it. I'd never been someone else's dream before, though people had accused me of being their nightmares. How do you stop being in someone else's dream? That whisper echoed through the room again. By waking them. She answered my question again. Shit. I was beginning to have an awful idea. Could the darkness become lost in sleep? Could the dark become lost in the dark? Could the mother of all nightmares be trapped in a land of dreams? Not trapped, the whisper in the dark said. Then what? I asked it out loud, and the body under the sheet rolled all the way over, feeling the silence with a hissing glide of silk over skin. My throat closed around the words, and I cursed myself for not thinking. Waiting. Still the air breathing around me. Not a voice. Not really. I thought really hard. Waiting for what? There was no answer from the dark room, but there was a new noise. Someone beside me was breathing, deep, even breathing, as if they slept. Though I would have sworn that the figure on the bed hadn't been breathing a second ago. I did not want to be here when she sat up. I so did not want to be here for that. What had she been waiting for all this time? This time the voice came from the bed. The same voice as the wind, faint, long unused, so hoarse and soft that I couldn't tell if it were male or female. Something of interest. With that last, I finally felt something from that body. I'd been prepared for malice, evil, anger, but was totally unprepared for curiosity. As if she'd wondered what I was, and she hadn't wondered about anything in a millennia or two or three. I smelled wolf, musky, sweet, pungent, so real I could feel it gliding over my skin. I suddenly had a cross around my neck, and the white glow filled the room. I think I could have seen the figure on the bed clearly by the light of the cross, but either I closed my eyes without remembering, or some things you shouldn't see, even in dreams. I woke up in the jeep with Nathaniel and Caleb's worried faces hovering over me. There was a huge wolf sitting in the driver's seat, its long snout snuffing against my face. I reached up to touch that soft, thick fur, then saw the shine of liquid all over the driver's seat, where Jason had shapeshifted on the leather. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, you couldn't have shapeshifted in the back cargo area? You had to shapeshift on the leather seats? It'll never come clean. Jason growled at me, low and rumbling, and I didn't have to speak wolf to know what he was saying. I was being an ungrateful wretch, but it was so much easier to concentrate on my ruined upholstery than to think about the fact that I'd been in the presence of the mother of all vampires, the mother of all darkness, the primordial abyss made flesh. I knew through Jean-Claude's memories that they called her Mother Gentle, Marmé, a dozen different euphemisms to make her seem kind and, well, motherly. But I'd felt her power, her dark